Hello and welcome to ROI, Relevant or Irrelevant, the radio show where the events of history are examined through the discussion of books, journal articles, papers, and presentations. Then historians and history buffs ask the question, what is relevant or irrelevant in today's world? My name is Jay Swords. This is our 552nd show of ROI, and our guest today is Dr. Michael Gunter, Associate Professor and Chair of the Departments of History, Science, Medicine, and Society at Grinnell College. And we're going to be talking about his book, Science and Civic Culture, The Politics of Knowledge in the Age of Improvement, 1720 to 1800. Joining us for the second segment of the show will be our history buffs, Rick Sweet and Terry Toppler. So first of all, Mike, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm really excited to be here.
We are excited to have you here. This is a topic that we think a lot of people won't know a lot about, so it'll be very exciting to kind of explore that. So the first segment here is called Farooq Dinaran. Our goal is to sort of help our listeners get a little background. So start us off with just some basic information. When and what is the Age of Improvement?
Yeah, in the 18th century, which is the focus of my book, the word improvement was probably one of the most important words in the vocabulary of people that were excited about the Enlightenment. And so rather than use the term Enlightenment itself, I use the term improvement because it's about applying the principles of reason and the goal of progress to the everyday world, that the world can be improved by applying the tools of reason, by working together, that you're not bound by fate or by how things have been done in the past, but that you can choose to redesign or to quote one of my favorite people, Thomas Paine, to begin the world anew, that at any time you can choose to improve it and make it better. And so that active side of the Enlightenment of trying to make the world better and to try to apply, in my case, what I focus mostly on is the world of science. So trying to apply science to everyday walks of life to make better agriculture, better public health, bring lighting to streets in cities, so that kind of active side of, and what I also kind of hearken to in the title of the book about the civic culture of the Enlightenment, of not so much looking to the next world, but to this world, that as citizens we can work together to make life better for the entire community. And so that's the kind of world that I wanted to, and the story I wanted to tell. And it's one that hadn't been as focused upon because most historians of science were interested in the great theories of science and the great developments of people like Newton or Darwin, not so much in street lighting and agriculture. And the same thing with historians of the Enlightenment. They had been focused on people like Voltaire and Locke and the kind of high treatises and great works, which I also find fascinating, of the Enlightenment. But I wanted to tell this kind of earthly story of people working together to improve society. And then what drew me to the topic was that these were the people that became involved in the Age of Revolution. These were people who became very political. So Benjamin Franklin is kind of the protagonist in some ways of my story. He kind of embodies all these trends of someone who was trained through the world of Enlightenment to try to make society better, to improve it. And he didn't set out with huge political goals, revolutionary political goals in that way. But when other ideas pushed him that way, I think the Age of Improvement gave people the tools and the networks and the confidence to imagine that they could reform the political world as well. And so that's ultimately my book is about the connection between improvement, politics in the revolutionary sense, and knowledge.
Okay. You led me right into my next question because I was thinking most people, when they think about this time period, are thinking about those folks you talked about, Voltaire, Darwin, whatever. But I would imagine you have a different set of major players that our audience might not have heard those names as often or might not recognize who they are. So can you kind of give us a sense, who are the sort of primary individuals that you kind of focused on and whose ideas and applications you sort of honed in on?
Sure. So some of them will be familiar to people. I mentioned Benjamin Franklin, or let me give the example of Thomas Paine, who people are familiar with the American Revolution think of him as the foremost political theorist and writer. But Paine came to America as a mathematics teacher. And most of his time in America and also his involvement in the French Revolution, he portrayed himself as an engineer, as someone who was trying to sell new bridge designing techniques and stuff. So part of George Washington, if you think about famous people that will be familiar to your audience, to all of us that are interested in the 18th century or the Age of Revolution, Jefferson, they all have a foot in the world of science. And so part of what I do is to kind of remind people that, especially in this moment in time in the 18th century, in this context, their scientific activities really mattered and were really important. And I mentioned Franklin, you know, as another one. So part of it is reclaiming figures that are famous but not really thought of as much in the world of science. But then another part, to your point, are figures that won't be as familiar. So I focus a lot on societies, clubs and organizations, and they were often called improvement societies or sometimes even premium societies because they offered rewards. They pooled the money of their members to offer a premium or a reward for the best new technique for, you know, fighting a particular disease or planting a crop. They listed these long kind of advertisements. Anyone that has an improvement in these spheres of life that we're trying to address will give you a 20-pound reward, you know, or a gold medal for the best, you know, X kind of item. So William Shipley is someone who I think is a really fascinating character. So he is a drawing master in England. He starts a society for the improvement of arts, agriculture, and commerce. And it ends up, you know, he's not a wealthy person. He's a, you know, kind of an artisan, a drawing master. But this club ends up eventually having 6,000 members, all the kind of largest names of the 18th century, and they're giving out these awards, and they create networks of correspondence and of participants that stretch almost the entire globe. And so I think the project is, to me, interesting because I do try to recover people who made a huge impact but are forgotten, people like William Shipley. And then, like I said, also figures that will be familiar to people, but they'll look at them in a new light when they're reminded of their kind of scientific thing. I don't know if there's time, but another example is I end my project with a figure named George Logan. And if you watch modern politics, every once in a while, people will talk about the Logan Act. It gets invoked every 10 years or so. It says that private citizens aren't allowed to engage in foreign policy if they're not working for the government. And that was an act passed because George Logan, who was this prominent Philadelphia scientist, went over to France and engaged in diplomacy and tried to create peace between America and French during the age of the Revolutionary Wars. And John Adams and the Federalists were so angry that he was out there acting on behalf of the government that they passed a congressional law that still stands that says that private citizens can't engage in diplomacy. So I bring him up just because it's this example of how science is often at the heart of these stories about politics and about what people can do because of the networks that they're connected to. So it's a mix of, you know, kind of famous people seen through a new light, and then, as you were kind of suggesting, to a lot of characters that are a bit hidden or forgotten, because again, they're not famous scientists that will appear in history of science textbooks, nor are they usually famous politicians, but they're the kind of people who built the infrastructure, the giant kind of economy of knowledge and of civic ties that I think was needed for these loftier figures to succeed. Because the last thing I'll say is, to me, what is amazing about the 18th century is mass mobilization. People had always been upset with taxes, and there were revolts all throughout European history and American history. But the idea that people who didn't know each other, who lived in distant communities, who barely spoke the same language, you know, had religious differences, that all these people could organize over vast distances to coordinate huge movements that had to exist outside of government, that to me is what's amazing about the 18th century. And that's kind of what I try to explain as a historian. How did they do that? How did they organize like that?
Okay. Well, as you can see, we have a lot more to talk about. So please stay tuned for the next segment of our show. This is ROI on KALA, St. Ambrose University, 106.1 FM.
In times of joy, in moments of grief, broadcasters come through, even when all else fails. Today, with more ways than ever to experience the moments that transform our lives, Americans still choose broadcast radio and television more than all other media combined. We are the local broadcasters of radio and television, reaching more people, touching more lives. Brought to you by the National Association of Broadcasters and this station.
Hello and welcome back to ROI, Relevant or Irrelevant, the radio show where events of history are examined through the discussion of books, journal articles, papers, and presentations. Then historians and history buffs ask the question, what is relevant or irrelevant in today's world? My name is Jay Swords. This is the second segment of our show, referred to as the Kitchen Table. Our guest for today is Dr. Michael Günther, Associate Professor and Chair of the Departments of History and Science, Medicine, and Society at Grinnell College. We're talking about his book, Science and Civic Culture, The Politics of Knowledge in the Age of Improvement, 1720 to 1800. Our history buffs today are Rick Sweet and Terry Toppler. Rick, why don't you start us off?
Thanks, Jay. Mike, I ran across your doctoral dissertation, Enlightened Pursuit, Science and Culture Through Anglo-America, in the 18th century, and I suspect that this book is probably extension of that work. Am I right?
That's correct. Yeah, it carries most of the same kind of ideas and themes. I've had to think a lot about how I wasn't happy with the way the story unfolded in the dissertation. Most people aren't happy with how their dissertation
unfolded. No, we're not.
Right. So I've been thinking a lot about the way, as a storyteller, to make this world come alive, to really get at the heart of what I find interesting about these people engaged in improvement and science. But also, it has to be kind of broad because it covers, you know, ages of revolution. So I've redone the way I structure the whole narrative. And I've been lucky to be supported by Grinnell to do more extensive archival work in England and the UK to trace down a lot of these networks and people. So the themes and most of the argument is going to be the same as my dissertation, but it's going to be structured very differently. Yeah.
Okay. Terry.
Yes, Mike, you talked about during the Age of Improvement in the 18th century that there was a phenomenon called mass mobilization where people were able to network, not just within their town, but across expanses. How did they organize back then?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that. I've mentioned Benjamin Franklin, and I think his autobiography is a wonderful glimpse into some of the techniques that were used by this world to mobilize. So Franklin talks a lot in his autobiography about how he wants to have, public education. He wants libraries. He wants a hospital. He wants street lighting. He wants many things to do in a community that's very polarized, and the government was very hard to get to do certain things. And so he talks about forming clubs. And so one of the things that he uses are these subscription techniques. So he goes around door to door and gets people to subscribe very small amounts of money and to sign articles saying, would you join the Society for the Promotion of Cleaner Streets in Philadelphia? And he's also very clever about how he gets very prominent people, socially prominent people, to sign first. And he knows how to kind of he's got a lot of emotional intelligence, how to, motivate people and offer rewards. And so I think this idea of going to ordinary people and signing them up, mobilizing them, when I look through minutes, and these societies are very serious in the way that they keep organized minutes and create a constitution and create committees, like they love committee structures. And I know a lot of this will seem boring to people, but they learn this this grammar of how to organize, how to raise resources, how to get people mobilized. And so that's one of the things I've been spending a lot of time trying to look at, is how did they do it? What's the mechanics by which someone becomes a trained civic organizer? To use kind of our words today. And so there were some really interesting techniques about subscription, about the formation of these clubs. Another word that we could use is voluntary associations. The Anglo-American world was just rich and filled with voluntary associations that taught people how to form committees, how to, write, organize campaigns and things like that. So yeah, I'm looking at a lot of those kinds of techniques. And the new structure of the book, each chapter, it's going to have a lot of small chapters that focus on a particular technique that helped people mobilize, and then broken up with some kind of case study chapters that pause and then look at a moment where science and politics intersected and how those techniques that I've been trying to look in each chapter isolated, how we can see them playing out to allow some new campaign that was kind of unprecedented in the way it kind of changed the civic landscape.
Michael, I'm interested We know that the American colonies are full of revolutionaries and rabble-rousers and whatever. We get taught all of that. But we also sort of get taught that England at this time is full of the opposite of that, that we have, you know, these loyalists and they're, you know, proud of their monarchy and whatever. And yet I suspect that image is not quite correct. So can you talk to us a little bit about what's going on in the UK and you know, because we don't think that of that as a hotbed of revolution, and yet I suspect there are certainly these folks who are maybe not trying to overthrow the government, but certainly are hoping to get street lamps in Whitechapel.
No, I think the scholarship has changed a lot on this, starting in the 1970s, because Britain had resisted the kind of revolutionary impulses, ultimately, of France and America. It was always, as you said, kind of seen as a conservative stalwart, that it had not succumbed to revolutionary fever. But then, you know, scholars were kind of reminded and started to look more deeply into the organizing and circles of radicalism that appear during the American Revolution. There's a lot of supporters in the UK of the American cause. And the Irish colony, Ireland, has its own uprising in the 1770s, inspired by the Americans. And so to contemporaries, they often actually refer to it even as a civil war. It wasn't always clear where the lines would be drawn. And American historians have paid more attention to loyalism as a serious force, and also the kind of politics and conflicts between Native Americans, who often sided with the British Crown. And so I think on both sides of the Atlantic, historians are more interested in a kind of a messier story of, like you were saying, this kind of the way in which it was a genuine conflict that tore apart communities all throughout the British-speaking world, rather than it just being a kind of polite and very clean argument between the mother country on the one hand that wanted parliamentary sovereignty and the colonists that felt like it was a, you know, infringement on their liberty and stuff. And yeah, people in the past did not see it in those clean lines. And so when you follow these scientists, they are the conduit through which people build these ties. So if you want to reach out to people in Britain, if you're an American colonist, to find out what are people in Bristol thinking, would they support your attempt to block Parliament? Scientists are often the network, because they're the people who are corresponding for 20 years. They've been writing to people in Bristol. They've been participating in campaigns, sending specimens. So one of the things I'm interested in is that scientists are these nodes through which people can communicate, and they have trusted connections and relationships. And so they're the ones that help people kind of figure out these dividing lines. Yeah.
All right, Rick.
Yeah, Mike, I'm curious. My graduate work was in looking at forces for modernization, primarily in what was developing world. And one of the things I kept running across was the opposition, primarily from religious and conservative philosophical people within the community. When you were doing this work on those forces working to make improvements that were necessary for, let me call it, civilized life, did you run across any of these great known and unknown movers and shakers who were stymied in some way by religious forces or ultra-conservative forces?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, unlike the French Enlightenment, where anti-clericism and a kind of a skeptical deism is one of the pervading themes, the English Enlightenment and in the colonies really marries Protestantism or religion in general with these ideas of improvement. This is God's creation that one is improving, and in general, most of these scientists don't see any conflict and don't, on an institutional level, engage with much conflict with the church. In fact, another person I could, you know, mention as a good example of this world would be Stephen Hales. It was slipping me. He's an Anglican clergyman, one of the founders of the colony in Georgia, but also a huge figure in the kind of the world of scientific improvement and things like that. And the numbers of clerics who are involved in this world, they and the church kind of gives its full support in terms of ideology to the idea of science and improvement. So there's not that conflict, which I think is important in terms of it. In terms of science being able to, I've hinted at this, but one of the things that science does in the 18th century is it says, if you want to improve society, politics is broken, it's polarized, the government won't do anything. Come to our world, come to our club, come to our kind of civic realm, and you can actually do stuff and be active and, you know, improve society. And so they're able to kind of carve out this role of themselves as a civil society. They're the space where you go. And I imagine if the church had been opposed to that, that would have, you know, created real problems for them. It would have been far less successful. So I think that's important. But they did face, to your, you know, the other point, they did face conservative forces that didn't like what they were doing, often sometimes from the government. The government was kind of like, who are you to build roads or to offer premiums or to set up a hospital? Or, you know, there was attempts in the 18th century to start all these exploration campaigns to send ships to look for the Northwest Passage. And so the government was sometimes a bit confused that private citizens were sending out explorations, and the dividing line between public and private got some pushback and some resistance from the government, more than the religious elements, I guess, is what I see in the sources I look at.
Sure.
That answers your question. Yeah.
Terry.
Yes, Mike, I'd like to talk a little bit more about the establishment of schools during this time period. Mm-hmm. I understand that you've seen new theaters and libraries. Were they only established in the urban areas or also the rural? Were there restrictions as far as gender? Can you talk about that, please?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So I would say that in the records and the groups that I look at, the library is to them the key source of kind of the spreading of enlightenment. They're big fans of schools, and in urban areas, it really is more an urban story. There's an attempt to create new kinds of schooling by these civic groups, especially since the traditional schooling curriculum had been so classical and so kind of medieval in its focus. And so someone like Franklin sets up the Academy in Philadelphia that teaches, you know, science and poetry, modern English, literature, writing, all the things that you'd see today in a college curriculum, but that would not have been part of that older world. But what they really are excited about is the idea of libraries and letting people kind of self-educate. And so there you see it pushing more into rural areas. So people form these subscription libraries where just for a small amount of money, women included, can, you know, check out books, have access to material, printed, you know, texts that are cheaper to circulate. So there's a lot of these books that are like science made easy, that are made for families to use. So if you're living in, you know, upstate New York in the 1740s, you can purchase an inexpensive book that will allow you to teach your family, children, other members about chemistry, physics, about kind of the Enlightenment worldview. So there's a lot of effort in that more than formal schooling, I think, just because it was seen as really expensive and kind of confined more to rural areas. The role of women is one that I'm really thinking a lot about and trying to think about in this book, because they do play an important role in some of the clubs, and women are involved in science. Kind of, you think about the movie like Hidden Figures. When you look at who does science, you know, not who publishes, but who does science, you almost invariably find that families are involved, women are involved, especially in the crafts in London. Women inherit their husband's workshop when the husband dies, and so you find women making telescopes and, you know, just involved. So I don't want to fall into the trap that women aren't involved. But it's also true that these civic clubs tend to be male-dominated. And I need to think about what that means for a story. If I'm saying the origins of civic culture, you know, and the politics of knowledge are in this world, and yet I'm not entirely sure what to make about the role of women, that's a big, I'm just going to be honest, that's a big problem for my argument and for thinking. Because I think if you exclude half the population, that's going to take a lot of the explanatory power away. So you've put your finger on something I'm really kind of grappling with, and the book is by no way means done. And I'm trying to think about, you know, how much are women participating? How much can I show it? And if they're not, what am I going to do with that? Like, how do I interpret that and make sense of their exclusion?
Right. Mike, I'm interested. We had a a radio show a couple of weeks ago in which the individual was talking about how corrupt governments in the United States in the late 1800s and early 1900s actually spearheaded the development of modern sanitation systems in cities because there was a buck to be made. So what happened was the reformers, the scientists, the sanitarians was the word that she used, you know, found that they had to sort of get in bed with these guys. If they were going to accomplish the end that they wanted, they were going to have to be willing to live with the means a little bit. And so that got me thinking of what you're talking about here, where you have these scientific communities, these societies or you know, whatever, and they're trying to get things done, practical things done that are, you know, the application of science. And, you know, so did you find that there was some of this sort of, you know, I hold my nose and I get into bed with this person because, or this government or this agency, because that's how it's got to be done and if I'm going to get anything accomplished?
I did find that. The Society of Arts that I mentioned, which is this London-based premium society, and there's other ones like the American Philosophical Society in Philadelphia, but this London one has some of the most amazing records of their committee meetings where they wrote down all of this. And a lot of that kind of thing that you described, that dynamic appears where they're offering a reward for the best steam engine, and then quickly this becomes political, or, you know, particular interests are like, you cannot give the award to this engineer because this other engineer is the one connected at court, and, you know, and so these things come up and there's fights. And I think what I get from these stories is I think that was helpful to this group of people in terms of teaching them to be pragmatic as they move forward, right? Because as I was saying, I think one of the themes is how do you mobilize and work with people that are so different from you to achieve hard goals? I think that's just really hard, you know, hard to do. And thinking of the program's title, Relevant or Irrelevant, it's what I find really relevant about this 18th century world is seeing these people build the skills. And part of that skill is learning to be disappointed and get only half of what you want, or having to kind of sometimes. Now, another historian might look at it totally different and see like forms of selling out or forms of, you know, compromise and things like that. But I would say that I definitely see that in the organizations that have really good documents. Sometimes it's hard to see because it's just not written down the 18th century. But the really good minute records do reveal people having to work with established interests and being upset about it and often finding ways around it. And I think that makes them better at what they do. But I should think, too, about some examples where it doesn't make it better. I think, you know, as a historian, I think it's really good to look at the examples that support your case, but also the ones that run counter, and to really look and analyze and think, why did it fail and other things. So you're kind of inspiring me to focus a little bit more maybe on some of the cases, because there are also ones where societies blew up and just disbanded because of something like you described. So, you know, I don't want to suggest that they had magical powers, but I like what you're putting, yeah, the emphasis about if you really want to engage in civic reform, it's never going to be a clean process, right? And so how did this group do it, and how does that? I could probably learn a lot from reading, you know, that work on 19th century sanitarians or 20th century modernizers. You know, people around the world have dreams just like the Enlightenment had dreams. The question is, what tools and experiences and techniques did they use to achieve them? Where did they succeed? Where did they not? What do we learn by studying those patterns? Yeah.
All right. Well, when we come back, we're going to wrap things up. So please stay tuned. This is ROI on KALA St. Ambrose University, 106.1 FM.
You're listening to Relevant or Irrelevant. This series is produced at St. Ambrose University's KALA Radio and has been honored by the Midwest Broadcast Journalists Association and the Iowa Broadcast News Association for excellence in public affairs journalism. You can hear this edition of ROI and many previous programs in this series by visiting Spotify, Google Podcasts, SoundCloud, plus Apple Podcasts. ROI airs Friday nights at 9:30 p.m. on KALA HD2 and can also be heard at 106.1 FM in the metropolitan Quad City area. You can stream this show every Friday night at TuneIn.com. Search for KALA HD2.
This concludes our 552nd show of ROI, Relevant or Irrelevant. Our producer and engineer is Dave Baker. Our program manager is Rick Sweet. And the theme song of our show is titled Kayla's Theme. It was written and performed by Mark Zapsapital. My name is Jay Swords. We'd like to thank our guest, Dr. Michael Gunther, Associate Professor and Chair of the Departments of History and Science, Medicine, and Society at Grinnell College. We've been talking about his book, Science and Civic Culture, The Politics of Knowledge in the Age of Improvement, 1720 to 1800. The history buffs for today's show were Rick Sweet and Terry Toppler. This is ROI, Relevant or Irrelevant, on KALA. The views expressed on this show are not necessarily those of St. Ambrose University or KALA. We would like to wish all of our listeners to experience the great Basutu proverb, Hotso Pola Nala, peace, reign, and prosperity. And remember, historians are horrible fortune tellers. Good night.